The relief of a successful cancer treatment is all too often marred by a distressing, lingering uncertainty. Will my cancer come back? The devastating reality is that cancer cells can run and hide. They can tuck away and lie dormant in different parts of the body, often inside bone, for years before waking up to spread once again. In today's episode, we speak to a Garvan researcher who is tackling one of the toughest problems in cancer research. How can we track cancer cells on their way to becoming dormant? How can we stop them from waking up? And how can we eradicate them from our system completely? You're listening to Medical Minds, the podcast that takes you inside the labs at the Garvan Institute of Medical Research. I'm your host, Dr. Vivian Richter. And with me here is Professor Peter Croucher, head of the Bone Biology Lab at Garvan. Welcome, Peter.
Hi, Vivian. It's great to be here.
Peter, before we talk about how you're tackling this critical problem in cancer, could you tell us where your inspiration to become a scientist came from?
So I'm a zoologist. I was brought up in the very southwest of the UK, and in my formative years, I spent time collecting animals and had fish tanks and all sorts of creatures that I used to look after. And then when I went to university, I did zoology. And as part of my zoology training, I spent some time in a lab doing medical research, looking at the role of cancer drugs in the immune system. So once I'd finished my time at university, I chose to do a PhD and was asked or given the opportunity to do a PhD in skeletal biology.
What was it about skeletal biology that really interested you?
When I was offered this opportunity, I met somebody that was actually working on osteoporosis. And this is obviously a pretty devastating disease that affects the skeleton. You lose bone and have pathological fractures. So it excited me that we could actually spend time trying to understand this disease and develop new approaches to treating that. So I started my PhD. We were using rather old technology at the time to investigate how bones changed over time. And in fact, we spent time using sort of old-fashioned computers that would fill a room now, using histological slides to try and measure things in those slides and understand how the cells that control bone take away bone and cause the sort of devastating effects on the skeleton.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the specific project that you were working on?
So we were interested in the cells that resorb bone. And these are important cells because they take away bone that's not mechanically competent and need to be replaced. And these cells are called osteoclasts. And at the time, we had little or few approaches to being able to study this in people. So we were taking samples of bone from people using histological approaches to identify these cells, and then using image analysis tools, using very old-fashioned image analysis computers to actually quantitate and measure the changes in bone that were going on in patients with osteoporosis and other disorders as well.
What did you learn?
Well, we found that different types or different patients would have different outcomes in terms of osteoclastic bone resorption. So, for example, if you have postmenopausal osteoporosis, you would resorb more bone than you would do normally. And we found that the sites where bone resorption was going on, you had many, many more of those sites. So it opened up the opportunity to think about how we could actually start to treat diseases such as osteoporosis.
So the inside of bone is quite a dynamic environment.
Now, that's absolutely right. So bone is itself a very difficult tissue to understand and study. It's a sort of hard tissue. It's inaccessible. There's an outer layer of bone that you have to penetrate before you can see inside a bone and then actually study what's going on in that environment. So inside of bone, you have all your bone marrow, which is the site of blood cell formation and where your immune system is developing. And on the surface of bone are all the cells that are responsible for controlling bone and changing that bone over time. But at the time I did my PhD, the only tools we had were really histological tools. So you got a snapshot in time only. And seeing that complexity and the dynamic changes in bone was always something that was an aspiration when I started my PhD.
And where did you go from there?
So after I completed my PhD, I went to Cambridge. I spent some time working with my PhD supervisor, but she gave me this opportunity to go and work in a different lab to gain some different experiences. So I went and worked at the Laboratory for Molecular Biology, which is a very well-known laboratory in Cambridge where people do a lot of molecular biology. And I spent time working with a hematologist there, learning molecular biology and applying that to study the skeleton. And it was while I was there that we really got interested in cancers that grow in bone. And one of the most devastating cancers that grows in bone is a disease called multiple myeloma, which is a blood cancer. And that lives in the skeleton and hijacks the normal processes that go on in bone. It causes sort of devastating osteolytic bone disease. And this is largely mediated by osteoclasts resorbing more bone than they should do. And it's become a sort of model in some ways for an extreme form of bone loss.
So Peter, how are you investigating this disease?
So one of the things we recognized was it was particularly difficult to study myeloma in patients. So we spent some time developing animal models of multiple myeloma. And this turned out to be a sort of pretty wise decision because we were able to use these models to understand how myeloma cells hijack bone, how they cause bone disease. But we discovered some molecules that the tumor cells had actually hijacked in the bone environment, and that actually caused more osteoclasts to form. And that discovery led to the development of a new treatment that ultimately is one of the most widely used treatments in the study or in the treatment of patients with multiple myeloma.
What's the treatment?
So we discovered a molecule called RANK ligand, and this particular molecule is now being targeted by an antibody called denosumab, and that's now widely used in the treatment of bone disease, not just in myeloma, but also in patients with osteoporosis.
That must be an incredible feeling to know that the research that you were involved with is helping to change the lives of many people today.
Yeah, it's super exciting. It's clearly a huge team effort and many, many individuals are involved in this, but actually contributing in some small way, yeah, is incredibly humbling, really.
And do you think this treatment has changed the dial?
I think so. So when I first started research in multiple myeloma, there were few treatments for the devastating bone disease that occurs in this particular disease. So I think over the last decade or so, we've seen the introduction of two new treatments, both of which we've worked on and contributed to the development of. Individuals that have myeloma will commonly present with bone disease. And in fact, almost all patients will have some form of bone disease during the course of their myeloma. And prior to working on this, we had very, very few treatments for those individuals. But now an individual coming into the clinic will typically receive one of these treatments. So of the 1,200 individuals that present to the clinic each year in Australia with multiple myeloma, many of those individuals, if not all of them, will ultimately be offered this particular treatment.
Peter, where did you take your research from here?
So having spent time in the UK, I found myself as a head of department in a university environment, and I was considering what my options were, whether to stay in research or stay in university administration. I was contemplating this quite considerably, and then I was phoned one day by an individual in Australia, and he said to me that the Garvan Institute was looking for a new director of the bone program. So I was invited to come and visit the Garvan Institute. I spent some time here and realized what an exciting opportunity that would be. So about 12 years ago, we made the decision to leave the UK and move to the Garvan and establish our laboratory again at the Garvan and take on the responsibility for what was called the bone program at the time.
And what problem were you specifically looking to understand?
So one of the most important problems we were looking to address was still how do we make bones better for individuals with multiple myeloma. And ultimately, we'd learned through the studies in animal models that whenever you targeted the skeleton to try to treat the bone disease, we would reduce tumor burden and reduce the development of myeloma in these animal models. So that gave us some important insights and clues to how these tumors were growing in the skeleton. It made us realize that they were probably very, very dependent upon the environment or the skeleton for their survival. So we recognize that really, if we're going to have true impact, we've got to stop myeloma developing in the skeleton altogether. And the way we felt we could tackle that is going back to the very, very first cell when it arrives in the skeleton for the first time and sits down in that environment and settles into that place and starts to grow. So when we came to the Garvan, one of the things we did was we linked up with some colleagues who were developing so-called intravital microscopy. And that allows us to move away from looking at histological sections of bone, which was a very static approach, but to look in living organisms deep inside the bone as cells were moving around and arriving in that environment. And that was a watershed moment, really, because it gave us this opportunity to see things in real time in living organisms and seeing them, how they actually happened right in front of your eyes. And as we sort of say, seeing is truly believing. And this was the first opportunity to really see that in action.
Peter, take us inside what is happening in the bone when one of these cancer cells sets up shop.
So using the intravital imaging approach, we were able to see cancer cells arriving directly into the skeleton. And one of the exciting things was that we could actually see them sitting down in bone on the bone surface. And over a period of time, you could see that some of these cells would be woken up and give rise to new cancer, whereas many of these cells would just sit there in a long-term dormant state. So we've spent quite a long time now trying to understand, firstly, what holds cells in a dormant state, and then secondly, what wakes them up. And one of the first things we did was discover that the cells that we've always been interested in, osteoclasts, are able to degrade bone or resorb bone. And in doing so, they release these dormant cells from the control that occurs within that environment and allows them to grow and form a new cancer. And this may well explain why in the big clinical trials that were first done with the drugs that target osteoclasts, that these individuals were able to live longer. And it really builds upon a very early hypothesis that was proposed well over 100 years ago now by somebody called Stephen Paget, who was an English physician. And he made this observation that in women with breast cancer, their bones would suffer in a sort of special way. And he developed something called the seed and soil hypothesis, where the cancer cell is the seed and it finds its way into bone, and bone is a fertile soil that can support the growth and survival of cancers. If we can actually understand who has disseminated dormant cancer cells, we can think about beginning to treat them much, much earlier than we would do normally. So rather than treat our primary disease and then think when a disease relapses, we have to start to treat that, we may be able to consider treatments in a different way. Firstly, identifying who is going to do poorly, first of all. And then secondly, developing approaches that we can use to treat and eradicate dormant cells before they're woken up to cause relapsing disease. So you can imagine a scenario where you might come into the clinic and you're treated for your primary disease, but at the same time, you're also investigated and then treated for disseminated disease. And if you can stop that disseminated disease being woken up, then you may well work towards a likely cure for some of these difficult to treat cancers.
How many people could this have a potential impact for?
So it's estimated that 10 million individuals will be living with cancers that have spread to distant organs. And the skeleton is obviously one of the most common sites for that spread. So if we can actually identify which individuals are going to experience a cancer that's growing in a distant organ, we have the potential to have a very positive outcome on all of those individuals. We do have a long way to go. You know, we have identified these cells and we've done a lot of work trying to identify and work out the genes that control these cells. And this is providing opportunities now to think about how we can develop new types of treatment that either keep these cells in a long-term dormant state so they never wake up, or that we can eradicate them as dormant tumor cells.
And what kind of diagnostics and therapies are you hoping to specifically develop during this work?
So I think that's a really important question and a real challenge. I think identifying these dormant cells in distant organs, in the skeleton in particular, is particularly challenging. What we're doing at the moment is now we understand many of the genes that control these cells. We're looking in bone marrow aspirates to find individual cells based upon that understanding. So we're optimistic that that could ultimately be a way of finding them. and developing a test to identify and find those cells. But the real challenge is developing treatments, and those treatments might involve utilizing the power of the immune system to actually find these cells and eradicate them. And our understanding at the moment is somehow these cells are invisible to the immune system. They take on what we call a cloak, which is hiding away in the skeleton. So they appear as native cells would do normally in the skeleton. And if we can reveal these cells to the immune system, then we can leverage the power of the immune system to eradicate them. And that will be our aspiration.
And what sort of technologies are helping you get there?
So I think we've made huge improvements since the time of using old-fashioned image analysis and floppy disks to store data. We've moved through a period now where the introduction of intravital imaging has allowed us to study cells in real time for the very first time. The further introduction of single-cell genomic technologies is allowing us to understand these incredibly rare cells and all the genes that are switched on in that environment. And I think going forward, we're going to be able to leverage what is turning into a data science challenge with many, many millions of cells involved in the development of a cancer, millions of cells involved in the interactions that occur between a cancer cell and its environment. We need sophisticated computational approaches to enable us to analyze many, many millions of cells, thousands of genes in living organisms and ultimately in people. So this is going to be a huge data science challenge. And one of the things that we're trying to do is bring together people with different expertises, not just people like myself as a bone biologist or a cancer biologist, but immunologists, data scientists, genomicists, all to the table to be able to tackle this problem together.
Are you focusing on any cancer in particular?
So we're focused on three different cancers. One is multiple myeloma, and that's where we've done most of our initial discovery work. But we're also interested in cancers such as breast and prostate cancer that will disseminate to the skeleton. What we've already discovered is that these cells arrive in the skeleton and they localize to a very similar environment. So they seem to sit in the same space. And when they sit in that space, they switch on the same repertoire of genes. And it doesn't matter whether you're a myeloma cell or a breast cancer cell or a prostate cancer cell. So this offers the exciting prospect that we may be able to develop pan-cancer treatments that work for all cancers that are growing in the skeleton. And potentially similar approaches might apply in other organs such as the lung or the liver.
And your work has recently led to a clinical trial?
So we do have clinical trials. So a lot of our research now has moved into working much more closely with patients, whether it's patients providing samples that we can then analyze and study, or it includes new interventions. And we've definitely made some progress with a further new treatment, potential treatment for the bone disease in patients with myeloma. And we have the clinical trial that's just started in that space. And that is looking to replace the bone that has been previously lost. So whilst the early treatments stop your skeleton getting worse, the aspiration is to make it stronger so that it actually is resistant to future fractures.
Peter, before learning about your research, I had no idea that bone was such an active site of activity.
No, that's absolutely right. It's constantly changing. And as we've talked about, you have osteoclasts taking bone away and osteoblasts replacing that bone. So the skeleton that you had when you first started listening to this podcast will be different to the one that you leave with. And that's happening with all of us all of the time. So there's a unique opportunity there to change your skeleton, and we should all be very mindful of that.
So how can we change our skeleton for the better?
So use it or lose it is probably an important concept to consider. So the very fact that our skeleton is adaptable means that we have the amount of bone that we need. So if you don't use your skeleton, then you lose bone. If you use it, then it will be stronger for it. So if you go up in space, you lose your skeleton because you're not putting strain on your skeleton. If you're a tennis player, then your dominant hand will be stronger than your non-dominant hand. So the lessons from that have taught us that you have to use your skeleton. So exercise is a very positive thing.
Peter, before we let you get back to the lab, it's time for the Fast Five. What do you do in your downtime?
I'm a runner. So I've always liked running. When I was in the UK, we used to do fell running, which is running in the Peak District. The closest you can do that here is more trail running. So I do a lot of trail running when I get the chance.
What's the most challenging thing you've ever done?
Probably the most challenging thing that I've done has been to take on the acting directorship of the Garvan Institute when our former director stepped down at short notice. That was a huge privilege, but also incredibly challenging. You know, we have some of the most amazing scientists at Garvan all trying to tackle really fundamentally important questions. Yet we're doing that in a complex and difficult environment where we have limited resources and funding. So making decisions around how we took the organization forward was particularly challenging.
Peter, do you have any secret skills?
I'm not sure it's a skill, but it's something that I've always felt that I could do quite well, which was actually read people. And at one level, that's been advantageous because you can actually understand people's motivations. But another level, it's a bit of a curse because you can often see the car crashes happening before they occur.
What's been your best holiday?
Probably my best holiday was a trip to the Maldives when Lisa, my wife, and I first got married. We decided we would spend 2 weeks in the Maldives. We were a bit terrified that being on a small island for essentially 2 weeks would be, we'd have nothing to do. So we took loads of books and even took work with us because we were so worried that this would be so isolating. But once we got there, all we did was snorkel for 2 weeks, and it was probably the most amazing experience I've had.
Favorite movie?
I guess my favorite movie is a movie called Sunshine, which is a Danny Boyle film. And I've always liked science fiction movies, and this is a great science fiction movie, but it also has an amazing soundtrack.
Professor Peter Croucher, thank you so much for joining us on Medical Minds.
Thank you very much for having me.
If you'd like to know more about Peter's research or donate to the work we do at Garvan, head to garvan.org.au. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave a review and share with other podcast lovers. I'm Dr. Vivian Richter. Thanks for listening. This podcast was recorded on the traditional country of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. We recognise their continuing connection to land, waters, and community. We pay our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures and elders, past, present, and emerging.